Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to this week's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. Our host this week is Mildred Lynn McDonald with Healing Conversations. Mildred Lynn will take you on a fascinating tour of the mind-body-spirit connection through a combination of healing conversations, hands-on personal growth tools, and a generous sprinkling of East Coast humor and warmth. Join her as she chats with John Symes, change agent, speaker, author, and a creative force behind the Pachamama Alliance's groundbreaking global initiative, Awakening the Dreamer. John will share what it means to have an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just presence on the planet. And in the spirit of generosity, John will also offer a special gift to our listeners. Mildred Lynn also chats with David Darling, Grammy Award-winning cellist, composer, and author. One of his most intriguing projects is Music for the People, a nonprofit organization that promotes self-expression through music and improvisation. Find out why David created the Bill of Musical Rights. Join us for this fascinating musical journey. We're excited. Give us a listen. Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable is an opportunity for all of our hosts to come together and share their thoughts, experience, and insights on a variety of topics that are of particular interest to each of them. Listen in as each host takes a turn as moderator. Today's moderator is Mildred Lynn McDonald, and our roundtable topic is Choosing to be Honest. Is your word golden?
Welcome, everybody. We're here in Studio C, Los Altos, California. And today's topic is around the vibrational theme of honesty and truth. Before we dive in, we're going to welcome our roundtable participants for this week. John Caracella.
Hi.
Deb Caracella.
Good morning.
And Hi C. Luttimers.
Hello.
So what we'd like to explore is honesty and truth, and how much that is valued by yourself and by society. People tend to massage the truth. And what I've noticed, because I'm an energy worker and I pick up energy, is that this massaging of the truth might have a little higher price tag than people anticipate. Something that you're speaking that's not in alignment with who you are as a human being or your personal truth or universal truth will erode or maybe take away a little bit from your personal energy field, your precious life force energy. So what I'd like to invite John and Deb and Hi C and myself to do today is to talk about honesty and truth and offer some suggestions or guidance for people who find themselves at an intersection point where they are tempted to tell a little white lie or walk away from the truth and rationalize it.
In our pre-discussion about this topic, Hi-C mentioned that there is a way of being compassionate in telling your truth if you feel that it may hurt someone's feelings or it's not in alignment with what they are anticipating hearing or what they want to hear. And there are spaces for some of the little white lies that we tell if we're using them in an attempt to be compassionate. But the bigger truths, if I say this, my promotion might be in jeopardy, or I can't really speak my truth about this because my job in jeopardy, or my ability to live in this home. So I'm not supposed to have pets here, but I have a cat. What's more important to you, following the letter of the law and being truthful, or your internal truth? I think my cat's more important than the letter of the law, and as long as I am conscientious, make sure that my cat causes no damage, who's harmed? So you have to make those choices within yourself. Do you want to be completely honest and follow all of the rules, or are you honest with yourself and who you are and what you need?
Thanks, Deb.
It takes me to a place where whenever you are confronted with a situation where you have to speak about something and choose to speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, or something else, it really comes down to thinking very deeply about the other. What is the circumstance that is confronting you? What is the person that's confronting you? What is the rule that's confronting you that you're contemplating skirting or deceiving around? And, you know, oftentimes we don't spend very much time looking deeply at the circumstances that we're confronted by. And we make decisions to tell the truth or not with an incomplete understanding of the real intentions of the person or the real intentions of the law or the real intentions of the circumstance that is confronting us. And as a result, we don't really understand the consequences of our choice to tell the truth or not. We oftentimes think we can and should tell a little white lie, or maybe an even more substantial lie, because we're doing a calculus on the costs of telling the truth versus telling the lie, and we're not actually looking at all the data. And I think what you said a little bit earlier was, we're not really recognizing the true cost of telling the lie because it impacts our life force energy. Well, that's a very sophisticated way of perceiving that maybe not all of us have. But one thing that you can do is look a lot harder at who is being wounded, how that wounding is happening when you choose not to tell the truth. My bias would be to say, look, tell the truth, because the truth is actually the lowest friction path in the grand scheme of things. Now, that might not always be the case for certain individuals at certain times, and of course, you know, somebody's going to kill you if you say the truth. That might set you back a little bit. Right?
Your life force energy is in very big jeopardy.
Yeah, talk about one next lifetime.
But there's a moment where, you know, hopefully you're not confronted by that kind of situation, but thinking, examining, feeling into the other to understand what is compelling the conflict that's created in you about whether to tell the truth or not is really useful to understand what the real costs are.
Mm-hmm. And there's also an art and science to expressing the truth.
I was just with a couple of friends of mine over the weekend, and they were talking about they had gone out for a walk in the evening in a relatively safe part of town over in Berkeley, and they went for a walk, and these guys came up with malicious intent, it appeared, and they approached them and got in their face, and they tried to extricate themselves, but they ultimately couldn't and had to interact with these people. And one of the perpetrators asked the woman, you know, up in her face, "What's your name?" And she responded, "Mom." Now, that wasn't her given name, but it was a form of the truth. And she was confronted by a potentially life-threatening situation, and her artful answer reflected into that person a kind of meaning that was not in conflict, it was not antagonistic, and it was a form of the truth, and it worked.
Well, one thing that Deb used as an example, like, say, having a cat when the rule says you're not supposed to, a lot of times what people are not willing to do is actually stand behind their truth. Because on the one hand, the truth there is you are not telling the truth or living honestly because you're breaking the rule.
Correct.
But if they're then found out, what we often see now is it gets turned around to the other person is at fault, and therefore I don't have to take responsibility for having done that, for having thought my truth was important enough to break this rule. Mm-hmm. Versus, well, their rule is stupid, and if they take my cat away, I'm going to sue them in court. So I think part of that truth is, if I'm going to say this is my truth and stand in it and act accordingly, then I'm also going to think, what are the consequences of that, and I will own the responsibility and face those consequences, rather than think I can stand in my truth, quote unquote, without any responsibility to consequence. And if there are consequences, then I shouldn't have to be held to blame, and I shouldn't have to suffer, and I should be able to find a way to make it somebody else's problem.
That's what corporations do, by the way. They externalize their costs. they dump their untruths, their incomplete assessment of the damage that they do out into somebody else's backyard. That's tried and true method that is rewarded by shareholders.
Now, if I was to say to you, your word is golden, how does that make you feel? Or does it mean anything? Or does it trigger anything?
Well, in the case of Deb, she is the gilded voice. La Voce Dorada.
LaVoceDorada.com.
Exactly. Your word is golden. It gives me pause, actually. It makes me stop and reflect on the importance of not saying anything too tritely or not saying anything without thinking. There's import to that phrase. There's heft to that phrase. And it does mean something. It means if you've said something, if you've made an offer, if you've stated something, you're standing by it. You're in truth with it. You are responsible, and you are going to fulfill, in a sense, a promise, because what you say is who you are. It has value.
And gold is seen as that symbol of perfection and of that highest value. And I would say it makes me not only think that what I say has to have that value and be conscientious about what I'm saying, and does it reflect that kind of perfection? But I think it also points to understanding the perfection and value of silence and of not saying something. So it says, if my word is golden, it means that what I put out there is going to be the thing that represents me and reflects me in the world and in other people's eyes. And sometimes not saying something, because I think people get so stuck in that phrase, you know, I need to speak my truth. Well, that is true to a certain extent, but it's also knowing when the right time to speak that truth is. And it doesn't mean that you have to stay silent if in an extreme your life is in danger. There are times when the speaking of the truth overrides the staying alive. But that's not, I don't think, a common occurrence. But I think that your word is gold also reflects on whatever comes out has to be or should be gold. Therefore, if you don't have gold to offer, don't offer something less just to fill the space with noise, versus stay silent until you have gold to offer, which actually means you have to go through an internal process, because there you start to think about alchemy. And so you have to take something that is less than gold, find the way to transform it into gold so that what comes out is in its perfected state, which means you may have to distill it down to the essence of what you want to say or what needs to be said, rather than saying a whole bunch of stuff around it. And therefore, it then comes out, if it comes out, holding that value and kind of that perfected essence, rather than just something that's out there. And then it's always, well, now let me explain. Well, let me take that back, but let me say this and that kind of thing.
Good point. What about you, John?
Heisey's comment about silence reminds me of a quote from jazz great Miles Davis, who said, it ain't the notes you play, it's the notes you don't. And that actually takes me into where the phrase hits me most, and that is that your words carry extraordinary power. The gold, it's like, it's when you said that, your word is golden, I had this image of golden light coming out of somebody's mouth, right? And that power that is in the word, that's in the spoken word, to change, to produce alchemy in the world around you, is so significant that exercising one's voice, exercising one's word with deep respect for that potency, kind of compels you to think and feel very deeply into the circumstances that you're in and the consequences of your words.
Now, the other part of the equation is, if you're in the company of someone who is honest and who speaks their truth in an artful, scientific way, my feeling is that you would feel safe and secure in the presence of that person.
I agree.
And a lot of times people do not tell the truth because they do not feel it's safe and secure to tell the truth. So it's a bit of a paradox.
Yes, somebody's got to start. There's huge power in the word. The choice to exert that power in the promotion of the truth, in promotion of the higher good, is anybody's to take, right? Mm-hmm. So, first one in gets to start building the beauty.
I would like to thank Hi C. Lettimers, Deb Caracella, and John Caracella for offering their thoughts today. Everybody, stay tuned for the rest of our show. Next week, moderating the round table will be Hi C. Lettimers.
Well, that's our round table for this week. Many thanks to Mildred Lynn McDonald and participants Deb and John Caracella and Hi C. Lettimers. Next week, our roundtable moderator will be Hi C. Lettimers. We hope you found this roundtable discussion engaging and thought-provoking. If you would like to join the conversation, visit facebook.com/fireflywillows and add your comment under this week's roundtable post. Stay tuned. Firefly Willows LIVE is proud to support Mikaboo Companion Bird Rescue. Founded in 1996 and operating throughout the greater San Francisco Bay Area, Mikaboo is a rescue organization for parrot type and other domesticated companion birds. Their volunteers, the heart and soul of Mikaboo, are dedicated to rescuing companion birds who have been neglected, abused, injured, or surrendered to them, with the ultimate goals of rehabilitation and rehoming these feathered beings. Mikaboo offers bird education classes to people interested in adopting a rescue bird, as well as to the general bird-loving public. Find them at www.mikaboo.org. Mikaboo is spelled M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O, or email them at mail@mikaboo.org. Information on how to make a donation to help the birds can be found at www.mikaboo.org or by emailing donations@mikaboo.org. M-I-C-K-A-B-O-O. This tip of the week brought to you by Mikaboo Companion Bird Rescue. Did you know some parrots can live up to 80 years? Common, smaller birds like budgies and cockatiels can live 20 to 30 years. Like people, an individual bird's lifespan will be influenced by its diet, lifestyle, veterinary care, and genetic makeup. Want to learn more? See Mikaboo's website, mikaboo.org. That's MIKABOO.org.
Welcome back. This is your host, Mildred Lynn McDonald, and you're listening to Healing Conversations from Los Altos, California. In a few minutes, we'll head to San Francisco and join John Sines, change agent, speaker, and author of Your Planet Needs You. John is also one of the creative forces behind the Pachamama Alliance's Awakening the Dreamer initiative that has been translated into 13 languages in 60 countries. John will share with us what it means to have an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, and socially just presence on the planet. You'll love his thought-provoking insights, and in the spirit of generosity, he'll have a very special gift for our listeners. Then we'll beam over to Connecticut, where David Darling, cellist, composer, and Grammy Award winner for Best New Age Album, will talk with us about his musical Bill of Rights, Music for the People, and the award-winning Young Audiences Art Program. He'll also share why it's so important to nurture musical expression in children. Join us as we take a fascinating walk down memory lane with a true American musical icon. After listening to David, I'm sure you'll see why he's often called a maverick cellist. And now, let's join John Sines in San Francisco. Why did you write Your Planet Needs You, and what was your source of inspiration?
In 2004-2005, I was stepping out of a very conventional, orthodox life in which I'd been working as a business consultant, and ultimately waking up to the fact that my efforts were simply greasing the wheels of the systems and structures in the world that are leading us away from a sustainable future, which are causing injustice, not justice, in the world, and which are leaving most of us feeling like we never have enough rather than fulfilled in our own lives. And I had to make a change in the way I was contributing in the world. In fact, I had to begin to contribute in a new way. I didn't know how to do that, and I had the great fortune to be able to devote some time of introspection and meditation to the question of what should I do in the world, what could I do in the world, and the answer came to me as this book. Mm-hmm. And so the book came to me as a message that reflected my own awakening and the necessary awakening of the human family right now. So it wasn't a premeditated strategy, it was simply a response to my own deep inquiry.
And has your inspiration grown since that initial time when you decided to express your soul or your heart through a book?
Well, since I wrote the book, remarkable things have happened that have lifted me out of a small house in Chester where I was, as this book was created, and moved me, as I said, to San Francisco and this work inside an organization with global reach. And my inspiration has shifted because I'm now receiving information and inspiration from so many other sources. People around the world I'm connected with now who are doing deeply inspiring things. People who are putting their lives in service of what they see is necessary in the world. And so I feel as if I now live in a much bigger, more connected world than I did back then. And the inspiration has increased in direct proportion to that. I mean, I attribute my inspiration to a force which is bigger than all of us, and you can call that the divine intelligence, the intelligence of the cosmos, some people call it God. And I'm really clear that that's where all inspiration comes from. And so for me, it's important to spend time every day in communion with that source. And for me, I start my day with a period of silent meditation. And I know when I'm in the regular pattern of using that, inspiration comes much more readily to me. And if I fall off the regular practice for any reason, I can sense it as well in my own disconnection from that.
I guess it's like the gentle floss for the soul.
That's a great analogy. They're not necessarily jobs we set out with excitement to do, but they become so important and valuable to us.
How has Your Planet Needs You shaped you?
A couple of things spring to mind. One is that it felt as if this book arrived in me at a certain point 7 or 8 years ago, and I couldn't write it. I actually went out and sought healing. I only knew that I had to shift something in me before the book would write. Mm-hmm. And I went to osteopaths, homeopaths, Reiki healers, massage therapists, numerologists. I went to a whole range of people to really work through whatever was stopping me speaking my voice more fully in the world. So I had to open myself up to be able to express myself more fully. That was one very necessary step. And then the whole project has taken me beyond what I thought I could see. You know, I wrote a book. I had no ambitions to be working outside of the UK. I didn't imagine living outside of the UK. And yet, by opening myself up, I now find that I'm operating a conversation with people around the world. I mean, it's remarkable. I was Skyping yesterday with three women in Barbados who are inspired to change the way that island operates and overcome the centuries-long history of oppression that's been in that part of the world. I'm in conversation with people in India about gathering together a coalition of people there that are ready to create a critical mass so the citizens' voice of the people of India can make a difference in that country. So I've been thrown into some amazing conversations on a completely different scale by following the inspiration of Your Planet Needs You. It's reshaped my whole life.
It sounds like you've had the equivalent of an out-of-body experience, but you're actually living it in the physical world.
Yeah, I look back and I wonder how all of these steps happened, but the guiding light throughout was a prayer. And the prayer was, show me how I can make the biggest difference in the world with my own unique set of capabilities and skills and experiences. And that was my prayer, and various completely unforeseen things have happened. And I continue that prayer, and I expect many more unforeseen things will happen in the future as well, Mildred.
Yeah, cheers to that.
Yeah, exactly.
John, you have a blog, and I was reading one of your posts called What Can We Do? And in that post, you mentioned that your understanding of the phrase, be the change you wish to see in the world, has evolved over the last couple of years. I'd love to ask you, what have you learned about the verb be, and who does John Symes need to be to walk the path?
I know what I used to do is confuse the verb be with do. I think that's an easy trap for lots of us. And I certainly was looking to do the change. So I would concentrate on the actions I could take in my world. And that might be actions I could take in my own home. And it might be actions I could take on a larger scale. But the verb that's there is be the change. And so what's it take to be somebody in the presence of whom transformation can happen? What's it take to be somebody that is not attached to the fruits of our action and prepared to be in action anyway? What's it take to be open to other people without judgment? What's it take to be open to other possibilities without expectation? Those are the more difficult shifts to make. They're way more difficult than changing the way you operate your household or in the way you make your voice heard in the world. Because that's really inner engineering. And so I guess the second bit is that who does John Symes need to be? I need to continue the inner engineering work and find my greatest expression. I don't know how deeply we have time to delve into that, but to find my greatest expression, I recognized a couple of things. One is I've got to shake off the personality that I've assumed over 50 years here on this planet, the personality that I've learned as a coping mechanism for the world around me. And I need to embrace the divine part of me, the part of me which is actually completely tapped into that source of inspiration. And the more I can shake off the effects of personality or ego, we might say sometimes, the more I can find the real true me, then the more likely I will be the change that the world's crying out for so loudly.
John, when you're in the being state as opposed to being in the doing state, do you feel somehow more connected, more centered, more calm? Have you ever thought about that?
I feel all of those things. Okay. It's a heart-centered quality of beingness, not a mental process, not a thought-led process. It's certainly calmer, more composed, more relaxed, slower paced. It doesn't mean things necessarily happen more slowly, but there's a slower pace. And I notice it in my whole body as well. I'm somebody that my body will give me very good feedback about whether I'm holding tension or not. My back is a great meter of where I am on this process of being and doing.
What I'd like to do is talk about the Pachamama's Awakening the Dreamer initiative that has been translated into 13 languages in 60 countries around the world. From my perspective, John, you're the creative force behind this. So you have a unique insight into how people welcome and process and integrate change in their lives. What are three things you've learned about human nature that transcends borders?
Wow. Well, I've had the privilege to learn lots of things along the way. And I do also want to just correct one thing, Mildred. Mm-hmm. I am not the creative force behind the work of the Pachamama Alliance. I'm one of a team of people here, and there are probably hundreds of people who've contributed to the work we do. And it's so interesting, given the conversation we're having. Our work is also sourced. We say it's the call of life. We're an expression of the call of life. So the work of Pachamama Alliance isn't some grand intelligent design by a group of human beings. It's something way deeper than that. And the Awakening the Dreamer initiative is a call to all of us as human beings to find a way of believing in and contributing in a future. And we say this beautiful purpose or destination is an environmentally sustainable, spiritually fulfilling, socially just human presence on Earth. And actually just that very phrase, naming that trinity of environment, society, and self, naming those as three indistinguishable facets of the same whole, is in itself a really powerful shift. And so one of the things I've learned about human nature is that there's something in all of us that wants to be in balance with the natural world, wants to be in balance with other people, wants to be in balance with ourselves. In many of us, that's veiled to different extents, but you know, when we can lift those veils, all of us want that future. That's one of the key things I've learned. I've also learned that when we're in touch with that part of ourselves, which I do firmly believe is in the heart, when we're in touch with that, we instinctively see what's needed around us. We see what's unjust. We see what's not right. We see what's destructive of life, not affirming of life. We see what's not giving us nourishment ourselves, but is sapping our energy instead of building it. And so the second thing I get is how attuned we all are to see and be able to work to correct imbalance. And I was challenged to find a third thing. You're asking me great questions. The third thing is I'm just humbled by how much wisdom resides in people, resides in all of us. And so when we're in touch with the possibility of this future, and when we're in touch with what isn't working, there's also an enormous wisdom that arises in people. Wisdom is different from knowledge. Knowledge can be accumulated by lots of people, but to apply knowledge in ways that serve is maybe a definition of wisdom. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That just comes to me. But wisdom is available to so many of us when we make the space to allow it to come out. And so I'm hugely emboldened by that, because it tells me that wherever we go in the world, if we choose to commit to this new possibility, then we have this huge pool of untapped wisdom to tap now, to find solutions, find ways forward. I love it. Yeah. I'm inspired by that, deeply inspired by that.
Where do you get your strength to show up day after day and do this work?
I guess, you know, we've already talked about how, I've mentioned how valuable it is to me to have a period in my day when I can sit in quiet meditation, and that's one place. You know, I thank my parents too for somehow inculcating in me a set of values which strongly held, and principles and values of justice and contribution and service, which really mean in some ways it's not a choice. It's kind of like what I feel I want to do and call to do. So the strength, there's a quality of what we're doing here which isn't work. You know, I would come and do this work whether you paid me or not. I need to be careful who hears that. But you know, honestly, that's how we got here.
Yeah.
I want to tell you, my wife and I in the UK 6 years ago, we were volunteering with the work of the Pachamama Alliance and selling copies of my book. We said, we're going to make this our life's work. And to do that, we had to turn off the last tap of income, the last stream of income that I had from the corporate world, which was some freelance consulting I was still doing. Within a month of turning the tap off on that older source of income, I got a phone call from San Francisco saying, would you like to come and join the team of people working at the Pachamama Alliance in a paid capacity? And so I trust that that is a divinely inspired message. And so here we are, paid to do this work, but a work we'd already committed to doing before we knew that this source of payment was available to us. There's been a deep learning about trust in that for me that's been really valuable.
Now, we talked a little bit about the Pachamama Alliance, and people can find out more about specifically Awakening the Dreamer on the Pachamama Alliance website. Can you share what the website is?
It is at Pachamama.org. Pachamama is this beautiful word from the Andes, the language spoken by the people in the Andes all through Latin America. The word means Mother Earth, probably more completely Mother Earth, Father Sky, all space, all time. It's this hugely inclusive spirit of the natural world that holds us. So it's Pachamama.org, P-A-C-H-A-M-A-M-A, Pachamama.org. And yeah, there's lots of information and inspiration there.
Now, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about are your core values as expressed in your book, and maybe you'll just give us a brief description of each one. Fair shares, living values, respect for Gaia, and ever after thinking, which I find ever so intriguing.
This is what came to me in the creation of the book. Fair shares is really expressing the innate sense of equity that we all have, I believe, and we certainly see it in our young kids before they get conditioned by the wider world to own things for themselves. We have a natural sense of wanting to everybody to have a fair and equal access to resources, to opportunities, and so fair shares is that there is a fair share for all of us. The second, living values, is really the sense that we find a way to express the deeply held values that we have in the choices that we make. So if we live from our values, it points us towards being conscious of our choice, being conscious that we take choices that are reflecting the values of love and justice and peace that are, I think, the most deeply held and naturally held values amongst human beings. Respect for Gaia. We have the great fortune in this work to encounter, work with, learn from many indigenous people. And these are peoples who have grown up in the intimate understanding of the connection with the natural world. To many people, it's just how we live. We are part of the web of life. I was brought up in the UK, like many people there. Connection with and understanding of the natural world is eroded with time. We don't get to see the source of our food. The source of our food is a supermarket very often. And we don't get to have to deal with the consequences of our actions. There's somebody that comes to the house once a week and takes away what we call waste. And we don't have this connection with the natural world, and we lose a respect for it. We start to see the natural world as something that's there for us to use and consume. I really want to encourage this concept of respect for the natural world, connection with the natural world. And then the fourth, the one that intrigued you, ever after thinking, is, again, I've since learned that this is a deeply held part of the way many indigenous peoples live. It's thinking about the consequences of the actions we take today, not only for our children, but also for the children and the children of our children, 7 generations forward is how some indigenous people think. If we have the consequences of our action that deeply embedded in our thoughts, we'd behave very differently around the simple and often unconscious ways that we interact with the world, and we consume plastic bottles and disposable cups and actually many other aspects in our lives. We have much less of a consume and dispose culture, and we'd live more simply, and we'd be much more satisfied with fewer, longer-lasting possessions. It would reorient our world completely to truly have ever-after thinking.
I'd like to repeat these 4 core values for our listeners: fair shares, living values, respect for Gaia, ever-after thinking. And for those of you who are intrigued by these concepts that John just described, please access a copy of his book, Your Planet Needs You.
So, Mildred, what I'd like to do is, and I make this offer to the listeners, is I just have a box of books here. I think there's 45 in the box. I want to make those available to any of your listeners that particularly want to encourage teachers or people working with young people to request copies. For just the cost of the postage, I'll be happy to send these out. So,
great for stimulating conversation. So thanks for giving this gift to the world, John. And I believe that someone else involved with the book, too.
Well, my friend Phil is the hugely talented illustrator that did a marvelous work of putting my ideas into this visual form.
What do you have to say to people who are living a life that supports a broken world?
I'm curious what you mean by a life that supports a broken world, because I guess in a way we all live a life that supports a broken world. And let me explain what I mean by that. If we used your phrase, a broken world, to mean a world that isn't on a sustainable path, where we tolerate massive oppression and exploitation of millions, maybe billions of people, and where many of us are robbed of the peace of mind or fulfillment that is our birthright, then let's say we're all living in a broken world. You know, in some ways, Mildred, we're all complicit in that. We've collectively created a world that doesn't work. Sometimes it feels like we haven't created it, somebody else is creating it, and we're the victims of that. But in some ways, we're complicit in it. And anybody that's listening to this and accessing the internet right now is enjoying a level of privilege and access which isn't available to everybody in the world. And so we're all somehow tied up in this. And I think the most powerful thing we can do, this is being the change, not doing the change, being the change, is to find compassion in ourselves, in our own hearts, for ourselves, for the ways we're caught up and actually causing this world around us, and for the people who it's easy to look at and say they are causing the world as well. I think of government leaders, business leaders. It's very easy to point fingers at those people and say they have the opportunity to make decisions which affect our future, and they have more influence than we do. But I think we have to hold all of us in a spirit of compassion. And then it's way easier to engage people in conversation about a new possibility. People are immediately alienated if we go and point fingers and expect them to put things right that we're not addressing in our own lives. But if we approach this from the point of how we, for us all to wake up and say, well, we've all been in some ways complicit in the creation of a broken world, let's create a world that works for everyone. Let's create a world that's sustainable, just, and fulfilling. And so I encourage all of us to mend that piece in us that will allow us to mend the world around us and start anew.
People are saying to me, I feel passion in my heart. My heart is speaking to me. My spirit is speaking to me. I want to make a change. I desire to make a change. But I'm having a little bit of difficulty getting my inner world to sync up with my outer world.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a common puzzle for people and often disheartening. Do you have any sage advice, maybe even from your own life, of how to move from point A to point B?
I think the most important thing we can do is do something. We have this amazing workshop we created at the Pachamama Alliance. It's called the Awakening the Dreamer Symposium. And the effect it has for people is people get to see a different world is possible and that they want to play a part in making a difference. And then we encourage people in that workshop to take an action. And we don't tell people what to do, but we suggest some, you know, there are a whole range of actions you could take. And sometimes people walk away with grand visions and plan grand actions, and sometimes they walk away committing to doing something very simple, like not using plastic bottles might be an example, or reallocating a small amount of what they spend on, let's say, tea and coffee each month to help people in their own neighborhood or in some other part of the world who don't enjoy the same privileges. So it might be a small action that's a dollar a week, or an action that's about a plastic bottle. But that's the beginning of the process of lining up the inner world and the outer world.
When you take one step and you're successful at that step and it makes you feel good, it gives you the confidence maybe to tackle a second step.
Exactly. That's exactly the feeling I had when I put up a washing line and started hanging up the washing. It's like, I can take a small step. It's inconsequential in one perspective. It means nothing in the world that the dryer didn't go on for 30 minutes in my house. But to me, it's a life-affirming action, and it affirms that I can make a difference, and there I am. And it takes me on to the next step. So you're exactly right, Mildred.
Yeah, and it's the feeling, too, because from my experience, when you take that step that's in alignment with your highest interest, which, of course, taps into the beauty of nature, you're rewarded for that.
Mildred, it's like every one of us wants to live a life that feels meaningful and important and that is contributing to the greater whole. I think that's deep in all of us. Mm-hmm. And so any step we take that has us create a little bit of that feeling and then a little bit more of that feeling is powerful. You might argue that that's actually the most important consequence of being the change, is the work we do on ourselves that has us heal ourselves and step out into a more meaningful contribution in the world.
John, in your book, Your Planet Needs You, you have a lovely affirmation, and I'm wondering if you'd be kind enough to share it.
Today, I affirm again my stand for a future worth choosing. A just, peaceful, and sustainable life for the entire human family and our natural world. Help me to choose my thoughts and deeds to bring about this future by living lightly in balance with my planet home, by directing my energy and money to make the biggest difference, by serving those I love and the communities to which I belong, by standing up and speaking my truth, by shining my light in the world for all to enjoy. Help me to be the change I want to see in the world. Give me the courage to be true to myself and my purpose. Help me find a compassionate and loving relationship with the whole human family. And help me continue to be open to new awareness. Help me to overcome fear and act in the world with love. Through this, we will bring about the world we want and live a future worth choosing now.
John, would that affirmation be available as part of one of your blogs, I'm wondering, online?
It will be now.
It will be now.
I will be very happy to include that as the next blog that I publish on my site, yourplanetneedsyou.org.
Beautiful. What's coming up for you in the next year?
Well, there's a few things. In the work that I do here with the Pachamama Alliance, we're looking at how this work, this message, these tools are spread around the world, and I've got trips coming up to India, to the Caribbean, to South America, and looking forward to those. I'm always hugely inspired by the people I meet on trips to these very different countries, very different cultures, but the common theme of people who want to make a difference. I'm thrilled to be blogging and speaking out in the world more than ever. I think there's another book just between the two of them.
I guess there's you, but you have to say just a little bit.
Well, I'd love to, but you know what? It really hasn't come through clearly yet.
Okay.
So I just know it's waiting to happen.
When you say those words, how do you feel?
Wow, what a great question. So I'm feeling excited. I've got a feeling of a sort of level of excitement and a bit of adrenaline flowing. And at the same time, there's a sort of calm, accepting feeling, which is lower down in my belly. It's like, yes, this has got to happen. And then there's a sort of engaged curiosity in me. It's like, oh, what's the book going to be then?
I know there's people listening. They are saying, I really resonate with what John has to say. I love the idea of his book. I would like to learn more about the Pachamama Alliance or take a workshop or become a facilitator. How can we help these people?
Well, thank you. The easiest thing for everybody who's interested in that to do is to go to the Pachamama website, pachamama.org, pachamama.org, pachamama.org. And you should find there all of the information you need to get involved in this, wherever in the world you're listening. You might find there are activities already available on your doorstep, or you might find that you're a pioneer in your part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, we'd love to support you. We'd love to hear from you, and we welcome you as a fellow agent of change in the world. So the work we do as the Pachamama Alliance is serving the call of life. And everybody that's listening is somehow hearing the call of life, probably already responding in our own ways to the call of life. And if it calls to any of our listeners today more loudly or more clearly, we celebrate that and we offer opportunities to find our own next fuller expression as answers to the call of life. That's who we are, Mildred, and I'm just deeply grateful to be able to hear that call on the days when I can hear it loud and clear, and to be able to discuss it with you and our listeners today.
I'd love for you to come back maybe in about 6 months and give our listeners an update about what's on the go and what insights you've had, and I'm not letting you off the hook on that book.
I agree to do that, and only if you'll let me share some stories from the places that I'm going and the beautiful people I'm meeting and the amazing things they're up to. I'll be thrilled to come back and share. I'm sure the book will have some more concrete expression by then as well.
All right, we'll hold you to it.
Many thanks to John Symes. And once again, if you would like a copy of Your Planet Needs You, simply contact John at the Pachamama Alliance, cover the postage, and he'll be more than happy to pop a copy in the mail for you. This is your host, Mildred Lynn McDonald, and you're listening to Healing Conversations from Los Altos, California. In a few minutes, we'll head over to Connecticut and chat with David Darling, cellist, composer, and Grammy Award winner for Best New Age Album. He'll talk to us about the musical Bill of Rights, Music for the People, and the award-winning Young Audiences Art Program. But before we do that, I would like to thank Robert Cotter of Newfoundland, Canada, for providing his original soundtrack, Hope All River Falls, for our show today. Also, if you've missed an episode of Healing Conversations, or if you'd like a behind-the-scenes look at the show, please visit my new blog, onairhealingconversations.blogspot.com. And remember, you can always download episodes from Blog Talk Radio and iTunes.
Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/live. Stop by and check out Mildred Lynn McDonald's previous programs, or shows from one of our other hosts, John Carosella and Heisi Lutmers. Our live call-in shows are available too. Join us.
Now let's join David Darling to find out why he feels so strongly about nurturing musical expression in children. I'm sure you'll enjoy his engaging and unique perspectives on music, improvisation, and collaboration. So, without further ado, let's connect with the maverick cellist himself, David Darling. I'm so happy we're doing the interview. I loved your website. But after going through everything, I thought, oh my heavens, he must be like five men in one.
Well, you know, it's been a long life, and I'm happy to be alive at 71. When we get older, you begin to realize you can't do what you used to do, and your body tells you that, no matter how in shape you are or not. Yeah. I'm very impressed by aging, because it's very profound, and any time I see young people or talk to them, I realize, wow, I was there a long time ago. You know, the young energy is great. We've benefited from that in all kinds of fields. There's no ability to change the world in a way from age. It can happen at any time, anybody at any age. There's this woman who was just on PBS who was singing operatically. She's 13 or something.
Mm-hmm.
She has a voice that God gave her that is just like somebody who went to Juilliard, and yet she sings like an angel. And you cannot believe, when you look at her body, you cannot believe that she has the voice she has. And of course, she's becoming world famous, because it is actually astounding. I think it just proof that we humans are incredibly talented, and the more that schooling could be encouraging rather than negative is something that in my lifetime I'd love to see happen, where, you know, nobody gets dumped on. You can't sing in tune, you know, that's an old one. And it's, sometimes it comes from parents, sometimes it comes from your music teacher. Sometimes there's such pressure on elementary or junior high school music teachers, they have to put on a performance. And of course, mm-hmm. they get crazy because they get all the right notes. But that's not what music is about.
You know, yeah.
And I hope in the new consciousness that you and all of us are interested in, that we could get over this thing. It isn't about how you do on tests. It's how you do daily life and whether you can show whether you're a good person or not, or a good student or not. Mm-hmm. The more liberal the beginning education is very important. And, you know, I wasn't one of those students that was failing. I was always way up there in my class, except, you know, I didn't do so well with math and stuff like that. And yet, you know, my father taught me, if you can't do it, go to the teacher and ask them for some help. Mm-hmm. And I never found a teacher that didn't want to help. My impression at my age is that America has actually narrowed ability for human beings to celebrate who they are and what they want to do and how they want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important. You know, if I pay my taxes, supporting the school system, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to know is that all these teachers are also on the same high consciousness. And of course, unfortunately, we do have some people who have the right degrees, but they're so narrow-minded, really do not have high consciousness about what is really original in every child. My organization is about giving a lot of space and a humorous. I don't think anything can happen unless it's humorous. And then I would love to be in a system, which we've created in Music for People. And it's 23 years old, and we hold these seminars, and people of all ages, in their 70s and their 80s, their 20s, 30s, they all come together. Music for People celebrates what is natural, like what is biologically, what the earth we live on. You know, you can't say that that bird sang out of tune or that whale sang out of tune. That's, what a crazy idea. So why should humans think that every human is also unique unto themselves? And the problem is that there's so many people, so many administrators and stuff, and they have their own problems with politics, you know. They have to produce students that are up to some level. And mostly what gets lost is that the originality of every human being.
Mm-hmm.
In Evansville, Indiana, where I took my first job, I had this fabulous program, the string program of helping young kids. And I was happy to be there with a great job. When I went to the high school, you know, I had to teach strings. And it was a ghetto school, more or less. I went out in the hall the first day I was there, and these students would walk down. I'd say, would you like this viola? You can take it home. Because the school actually had an amazing amount of instruments coming from the 20s and 30s. Here I get invited to be orchestra director of this high school. And it occurred to me that, well, they have all these instruments. Why don't I just go in the hall? Hi, I'm David Arnett. Would you like this instrument? You can take it home.
Yes.
They said, yeah. Are you kidding me? You know, they were like speechless. And I took it home. And within 8 months, I built an orchestra. But there I was as a very young guy, not where I am today, but philosophically, I was interested in changing America by giving children or young teenagers a chance to be inspired. And I did. Actually, it worked great.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you give something to people, it really works well, especially for people who come from no support from their family or they come from all kinds of problems. I was always thinking, okay, not this child's fault, you know. Just taking a viola or a violin or a cello home free of charge, no problem, And this guy at the school, and of course in those days I didn't look so old, but they take it home, and even their parents are going, wow, where'd you get that? And I'm a heavy socialist, so you have to forgive me for that. But,
oh, that's okay. I'm a Canadian, and we tend to be that way too.
Yeah.
So we're on the same massage sheet, so to speak.
As a child, I was very musical. I came along, you know this term, enfant terrible. I don't know if I said it right, but it's true that I was like such an ornery kid. I was. Even at 71, I'm basically the same guy. And so they couldn't take that away from me. And actually, I like it. I've always been an improviser.
Yes.
Even in my youth, I found it very easy to improvise. And anytime I had to learn virtuoso concerto, I did it. And of course, I went to major conservatories to learn that. So I'm a classically trained cellist. But when I was 10 years old, a friend of mine played me Miles Davis music. And I just had a sort of a nirvana moment where I said, wow, I just want to do that.
Yeah.
Because especially the fact that they said, well, Miles is making all of that up. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's not reading any music. It changed my life totally because there was a part of me, even when I was a kid, taking regular cello lessons, trying to play classical music, that I realized when I was playing that I loved to do one phrase the way I'm supposed to do it, but then I loved inventing on it. My mother, who is my accompanist, which is an amazing thing, she would yell at me from time to time, you're not doing the piece. But,
you said, I know.
I know. Well, I didn't say I knew, but when you're so young, your mother and father are really the main things, and your sisters and brothers. I was a rebel, but not such a terrible rebel. I was just who I was. And so my mother and father put up with all of the stuff that I would go on a tangent, you know, I would do this thing. Because I realized that this thing about improvisation and jazz was so beautiful. From that time until right now, I've just been on a mission where all my records, all my CDs, they're about improvisation, and they're also about jazz. They're never about what I would call the word pure jazz.
Okay.
Because I haven't practiced enough to make it pure jazz. But over the years, through my relationship in Germany with ECM Records, you know, I would get a call to come there and play. But mostly what they wanted me to play wasn't so much of a jazz thing as they just wanted the mellow stuff that I could play so well.
Mm.
So I did that. And, of course, all those records are famous now. But it was never about me having enough technique to be invited to be with major jazz groups because I just don't have that technique. At this point, I'm not sure...
Well, you got this
part. You know,
yeah.
You know, I get up and I think I'm going to practice and get that thing together. Point is, at 71, you realize you're tired a lot of the time. And so you can't do too much, and so you have to concentrate.
I would aim for just the fun stuff.
Well, music is such a vast millennium of ideas, and so I learned in the past 40 years of that, there are all these concepts of style. And one of the biggest parts of my life is the fact that I was invited to be a part of the Paul Winter Consort. I mean, that was an 8-year thing. I learned so much, and we traveled all around the United States, every little college, and I played concerts with all of these amazing musicians. And actually, these musicians, even today, they're basically understood as being the greatest of their instruments. You know, Ralph Towner, for instance, the guitarist, he's famous as being one of the most progressive jazz guitarists in the world. And then Paul McCandless, who was an oboe player, basically, and he played jazz on the oboe that none of us could believe. He was absolutely out of sight. And of course, you know, you can't make a living playing oboe. But if you play oboe, you can also play saxophone and others. So he diversified over the years. And he's on many albums playing saxophone. But the guy is a genius. And then there was this bass player, Glenn Moore, who was a wonderful acoustic bass player. And he was also way ahead of his time. And most of the cellists up to me, they would play the repertoire. They would play Bartok. They would play whatever, solo unaccompanied. But when I went out to do, I knew that this was the normal thing. I went out and I just made up all this music, which actually wasn't new to me. I've been doing it my whole life. And when I finished, the whole audience stood up, standing ovation. And then Ralph Towner, who in a way is probably the most sophisticated virtuoso of that whole group. I mean, he's really a genius and a half. He came up right up to me and said, "Jesus, David, what was that? I don't know that piece." And I said, "Well, there is no piece. I made it up." And all of a sudden, my life changed because Paul came over and said, "David, been looking for you for a long time.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Would you like to do this gig full time?" And I had just got the best job, be a university professor of cello and conducting.
Yes.
In Kentucky. And Annie and I, my former wife, I've only been married once, but our first child just been born, so we had this very small place in Kentucky. But I went home and I said, "Geez, you can't believe this, Annie. That Paul Winter offered me a full-time gig playing the Paul Winter concert. I tell you, that's been a dream of mine forever. Would you consider giving up all this security to go on the road?" She said, "Of course." So beautiful. She said, "Of course, let's do it." Well, I resigned from Western Kentucky University. We started going on the road, and, you know, we went all over the world.
If other people had the courage to do that, what opportunities would open up for them?
That's, in a way, the essence of music for people, because the words that describe our workshops is sort of in that category. We might use different words. You know, we say things like, if you think you're tone deaf.
Yeah.
Or if you don't have any rhythm, and if you heard that from your parents, and it's classic, I would call it a naive parent, would say to their daughter and son, "Well, I never had any music talent, so neither do you."
Mm.
So they say that when you're 4 or 3. And, of course, we humans are very impressionable, so some stuff goes in very deep. If one of your parents would say something like that, you know, "I can't sing in tune, so neither can you, you're my child, blah, blah, blah," it's absolutely not true at all. I would never put that on my children. They're their own consciousness. When we come through the womb, we come from many places. You know, I really believe every natural birth is a person who has all of these chromosomes that will make them what they are. So I think this critical area from 9 months to 10 months to 12 months to half a year, when all babies look about the same. They look up at you and they're staring at you and they smile quite a lot, actually. There's something in the biology of humans I've witnessed all my life, and that is that most babies, when you're talking to them, they can't talk. They're just 3 months or 4 months. And, you know, you say, "I love you, I love you." And then you see them smile a bit. And, of course, cognitively, they're not doing it cognitively. They're doing it biologically. So I think all humans are biologically born into positiveness. So whatever they start getting in the very beginning, from their mother and father and brothers and sisters, is so important. And I'm sure in time to come that we will realize how critical that is. Children need to go someplace for socialization, but, you know, I'm not so sure it's what we have right now called pre-kindergarten, the discipline that we're asking young children to do in the very beginning, I have a lot of feelings that it's not quite as positive as it should be. I think that actually it would be great if nobody got any negative comments.
Right.
Whatever the learning system is, I would recommend that we figure out how to have teachers who are just positive, and all they have to say to children is, you're great.
Yeah.
No matter what they do, you say, you're great, congratulations, encouraging their creative ideas. Because what we have now is a system that starts to weed out very talented kids because of testing. You know, I failed all those tests. I was not a very normal student. I was an abnormal student, but I came from a family of great love and support.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow I didn't take it as gospel truth. I said, okay. Because I could always go home and my mother would give me a hug. And more or less say, I love you, David, no matter what.
Yeah.
And then from time to time, of course, they disciplined me. But there was some expectation. You know, I think expectation from families is good, that you tell your children what you know from life, but not that it death sends if you don't do it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing we need is for every child to be supported totally by their parents and then their mentors. I can't tell you how many stories that has evolved the past 20 years from people who came to Music for People, because they come from all ages.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of stories that are like, I would say 60%. They say, well, my piano teacher slapped my hand. Slapped my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, well, that's not too cool. And so they quit music.
Yeah.
Who wants to go to a music lesson and have somebody slap their hands and say, you're not doing this right? You know, we need very open-minded music teachers who have a big idea of what music is, not just a narrow idea, because there's many ways to get a child to play something that's on a printed page. You know, I have a granddaughter now, Erin. She's taking beginning piano now. And so far, the piano teacher is this fantastically high consciousness.
Yes.
So far, every lesson has been good, where mostly the piano teacher says, you're great, Erin, fantastic. And even if Erin comes and can't quite play what she would hope would be the next lesson, she's bright enough to say, okay, well, you need to work on someone, but now let's play a little bit. Let's improvise. And that's beautiful, you know, so that every music lesson should end in positive.
When I grew up in Nova Scotia, I would take music lessons, but no one talked about improvisation.
Point is that it's coming and it's coming. There's so much more information since you grew up and since I grew up. It's very positive about the value of improvisation. And Music for People is right on the cutting edge of doing that. So the good news is that this idea, this word improvisation, is taking on a much more humanistic idea. You know, it's not such a thing where if you use that word in a sentence to even music majors, there will be 70% of the students saying, oh, I can't do that. I don't have any idea what to do other than reading the notes. And of course, that's true. But the interesting thing is that you could also, in every conservatory, in every major music school, if improvisation was part of the curriculum and it was taught in the right way, those students who wanted to be more free, they would understand that they have a big fan club built in to play more free. And that those who just don't want to do it, but they want to play Bach perfectly, all of us have great respect for that. I don't have any problem with that. In fact, I'm a fan of beautifully created interpretations of the great masters. And so when somebody can do that, that's great. But if you take a young, let's say a young virtuoso who does that in he or she gets record contracts to play Bach or whatever. And so he does that. So now he's 10 years into a career. He has all the money, and he's going around the world playing these great masters. Well, as far as I'm concerned, go ahead and don't worry, because we need that. On the other hand, it's always interesting to me to see, because I'm older now and I've had people come who are like that. They've been doing this. And they call me, they say, I feel so dead as a musician.
Mm.
I'm playing all these notes and I get rave reviews, but I don't get what's happening.
If a person called you and said, I've spent 10 years and I've played all the notes perfectly and I'm experiencing accolades and success, but inside I'm feeling dead, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say that, first of all, congratulations, and I'm a big fan. In a workshop, if I knew there was a participant, I would play what they did, because it's always inspiring to hear Bach partitas played perfectly, and it's like, wow. First of all, I would try to remind them that what they're doing is so unique and so wonderful that I would love for them to, in a way, remember in the most humanistic way about the fact that they can control those genius moments and play them. And I would say to them, don't stop what you're doing. Do it more. And usually for people, we have two mantras. The first mantra comes from Taoism and Zen. The first mantra is deep belly laugh. So it's like this. So we ask every participant to do that, so that even though you've worked so hard on this and you know how many years you've done it, it still is quite simple, and it's quite what I would call Taoistic and Zen Buddhism, in which we give no importance to anything we can do. It's just one, and then this next thing is one, the next thing is one. There's no second or third thing. And they all have their importance. So just because you accomplished this and you can do it and you've lost track of how beautiful it is, the first thing that this virtuoso should do is to be able to laugh at it and realize, okay, so I did this, I know it, but I'm frustrated. What am I going to do next? So the next challenge is either to continue on that path of doing virtuosic work that, you know, the literature just goes on and on. There's so many pieces that are just so virtuosic that you can go on with that. But if you do it out of what I would call unhealthy items, then the classical musicians who are like that, who have come to music for people, we try to help them realize that what they can do already is nothing except to celebrate and congratulate themselves and feel good about it, but to realize that, okay, this is a beginning into improvisation. And this improvisation thing will change the world, because it will. I am positive that the world in the next 20, 30 years will change completely. And I'm sure that improvisation will become a huge part of what people do.
What makes you so passionate about improvisation?
Because I am a good example from the 50s about my conservatory studies, which I did very dedicated. I really practiced hard. But there was always a part of me when I played exercises that just kept coming up. I don't want to play this passage. I want to go here.
Mm.
So I was, in a way, a young composer. And so, you know, I think that schooling, what people do in school, should be 50% improvisation, 50% pragmatic ideas about how you read music. I think they're both equal. I would not want to ever sell one over the other. When I grew up, there was no idea about improvisation. It was only about, can you play this classical piece perfect? So, of course, my mother and I, she was my accompanist, we did all that. And I got all these awards for doing that. But, you know, at the same time we were doing that, I was so interested in jazz, I got my own band together. in junior high school because I loved this thing called jazz. And I had a father who was a businessman, a very successful businessman. But many times he came into the house, and then he was who he really was, and that is a person who loved classical music. He was 52, and my mother was 22.
Mm.
They met and fell in love during the Depression, and my father married my mother, this young, unbelievably good-looking woman. Wow. He would come home and say, "Thank you, Mildred. I see everything is set. We'll have dinner."
David, what was your mom's name again?
Mildred.
I nearly fell off my chair. It's so rare to hear. I know that name.
No. I mean, this whole thing, when I saw your name, I said, wow, that's cool. I can say easily that I haven't had in 20 years somebody write me whose name is Mildred.
I know.
So when I saw it, I go, wow, that's great.
Gentle strength. That's the meaning of the word Mildred.
Let me write this down, because that's an amazing thing. Gentle strength.
Yes.
Wow. And it describes my mother totally. I love this conversation because it's so much about who I am and what I've gone through.
David, with the musical Bill of Rights, when did that come in?
The musical Bill of Rights came to me in about a minute, 2 minutes. It was not anything I worked on. I just thought years ago when I was trying to define what I believed in, I wrote that stuff down, and it's become the Bill of Rights.
Okay.
So that's all David Darling is, nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just like I was trying to figure out what it was that I believed in. So that's what I believed in.
And has it stood the test of time? Like, if you were going to modify it, would you modify it, or is it true?
Right on. You know, there's nothing there. I mean, I could add a few things to it.
Okay.
But I'm so pleased that after all these years, it still represents David Darling, who put on paper what he believed in to help grow music for people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite amazed that it still works. Actually, everything there is absolutely the truth. That's the interesting thing, is can you write something that is the truth, but as an American, going through my American experience, mm-hmm. I like the fact that these principles are still truth. I still think they're all great. If you think that you're tone deaf, if you think you can't carry a melody,
yeah,
this will help you realize what is really the truth and realize that your sound
mm-hmm.
and your rhythm is the most important sound we all need to make.
Sounds like music is on the spiritual plane for you.
Well, let me just say simply that music is the highest, the most important, the most critical aspect of life. And music in its central form actually tells the truth about what we should do as human beings.
Hmm.
You're listening to the title track from David Darling's album, Eight String Religion. As shared earlier, David won a Grammy in 2010 for Best New Age Album with Prayer for Compassion. To learn more about David, please go to his website, www.DavidDarling.com. Also, check out his calendar for workshops in your area. In a few minutes, David Darling will revisit his musical Bill of Rights. Until then, please sit back, close your eyes, and enjoy his beautiful and transformational music. This is your host, Mildred Lynn McDonald. You're listening to Healing Conversations. Stay tuned.
Let's start at the beginning.
Human beings need to express themselves daily in a way that invites physical and emotional release.
Very cool.
Musical self-expression is a joyful and healthy means of communication available to absolutely everyone.
Perfect.
There are as many different ways to make music as there are people.
Exactly.
The human voice is the most natural and powerful vehicle for musical self-expression. The differences in our voices add richness and a depth to music.
Cool.
Sincerely expressed emotion is at the root of meaningful musical expression.
Perfect.
Your music is more authentically expressed when your body is involved in your musical expression.
Exactly.
The European tradition of music is only one sound. All other cultures and traditions deserve equal attention.
Okay.
Any combination of people and instruments can make music together.
Good.
There are no unmusical people, only those with no musical experience.
Yeah.
Musical improvisation is a unique and positive way to build skills for life expression.
Okay.
In improvisation, as in life, we must be responsible for the vibrations we send one another.
Perfect. That is it.
I'm going to give you a standing ovation. Here I am.
All right. God bless.
Okay. Bye for now.
To learn more about today's guest or one of the topics discussed, go to fireflywillows.com/LIVE. And for more information about Firefly Willows LIVE upcoming shows, visit our page at blogtalkradio.com/Firefly Willows LIVE. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in next week for Revolution with Heisi Luttmers. Next week's show is extra special. It will be the 25th broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE. We wish to thank our growing audience and celebrate the nearly 20,000 visitors to our Blog Talk Radio show page. Thanks for spreading the word and send us your thoughts and comments. We love hearing from you. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE, Blog Talk Radio.